This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. China is making some aggressive moves that are causing some nations real concern, but one nation that is showing itself not concerned at all is Britain. Britain is courting China. It's treating it like one of its best friends. Now, this is a really interesting trend with a lot of implications. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about why Britain is doing this, what the causes are for this move, and what it tells us about both Britain and China. And we'll also talk about what this shows us about the fulfillment of some end-time biblical prophecies. Very interesting discussion on this subject. Several nations are meeting right now for talks for peace in Syria. And guess who is participating? Well, it's the nation that until just a couple of months ago was being punished by sanctions from nations all over the world that were concerned about its dangerous nuclear program. Iran is now being treated like a legitimate peace partner, a nation that can really help resolve this quagmire in Syria, even though it has been more responsible than probably any other single nation for propping up the dictator in Syria, Bashar Assad, and helping to cause so many deaths and all these refugees that are creating such problems in the world. To make things even more bizarre, now Iran is threatening to withdraw from these peace talks if other nations don't play by its rules. We're going to talk about some of the ramifications of this surreal development in Middle Eastern power politics. Big archaeological news in Jerusalem, the remnants of a fortress used by Antiochus Epiphanes in his siege of Jerusalem in 168 BC have been uncovered. Antiochus is one of the worst villains in Jewish history, and this discovery has answered some questions that have long hung over this historical period. We're going to talk with archaeologist Brent Noctegal about this discovery and what it tells us about this fascinating history. And we'll finish off the program today by trying to answer an age-old question, just what is love? All this on today's Trumpet Hour. China is making some very provocative moves right now. There's been this big kerfuffle over dangerous cyber espionage against the United States, stealing millions of government records. China is snatching up territory in the South China Sea. It's doing what it can to undermine the dollar and to establish the yuan as an international reserve currency. So with all of that as the backdrop, it's very interesting to watch the way that Britain is treating China right now. Chinese President Xi Jinping just returned from his state visit to the United Kingdom, and Britain really rolled out the red carpet. It's been called the reddest of red carpets for the Chinese, welcoming with open arms, and officials said this was a golden era in Chinese-British relations. Even the Chinese state media called it an ultra-royal welcome. Why is Britain being so nice to China? I have with me trumpet writer Richard Palmer to discuss what's happening here. We talked about it some on the Week in Review program last week, but we're going to dig in a little deeper here. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So first of all, maybe you could give us an idea of just how much Britain bent over backward to show deference to China during this visit.
Right. Well, really, it's a trend that's longer even than this visit. And the first big thing came with the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank. And I actually remember, I think Rob Morley brought it up at one of our internal meetings back in the spring, and we were all a bit like, well, what's going on here? Britain is defying America in order to suck up to China. And that was just one of the first major steps in a big trend where Britain has really given a lot of deference to China. So they really did, as you said, rolled out the reddest of red carpets in this visit. A few weeks before, George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's, you know, in charge of the British economy, he was over in China. And he was making all kinds of statements like, you know, we're going to try and make Britain China's best partner in the world, and no other country is going to be more open to Chinese investment than Britain is. So that was just the kind of pre-trip tour. Then during the trip, they were trying to sign around $45 billion of trade deals Britain aims to be China's second biggest trading partner by 2025. And there are all kinds of just interesting little bits of flattery along the way, like government grants of over $1 million to encourage Chinese tourists to the north of England, $500,000 on the translation and archiving of Qing dynasty poetry. And then it all culminated in this big state dinner where President Xi was there, the Queen was there, most of the royal family was there. Prince Charles wasn't because he's good friends with the Dalai Lama. Mm. And these state banquets are a big, big deal. There's months and months go into planning. The table is laid several days in advance so that all the silverware and all the decorations can be placed just so. It really is one of the most royal occasions in the world. And they rolled this out for the Chinese, and it played great in the state media back home. And
back in China. Yeah,
back in China, exactly. And then they pretty much introduced President Xi to anyone who's anyone in British life, introduced him to all the celebrities.
So Britain couldn't, they couldn't have gone more all in than they did. They put out every trick they have in the book, every aspect of state pomp and pageantry, which they're so good at, they gave it to the Chinese.
Exactly.
So the big question, why are they making this decision about China right now?
Well, I think they see the way the wind's blowing. There's Stratfor had an interesting piece on their website, actually, just contrasting the Chinese empire falling, and Britain was the up-and-coming power when they kind of first met each other. And now Britain sees that the situation is exactly reversed. Their empire is gone. I think Britain's leaders very much see the country as a declining second-rate power. And meanwhile, you look at the statistics around China's economic growth. We were working, both of us recently, on that infographic for the next trumpet about Chinese military spending. And the increase in the pace that Chinese military is increasing just outstrips anything else in the world. It's a really dramatic growth. And if you look just at these trends, the world in the next few decades, and it's something that comes up a lot in analysts, but the world over the next few decades, if everything were to just, all the trends that we see now were to play out without any major interruptions, the world belongs to China. And so they've made this big effort to court China. Now, that's the kind of the more long-term view. In the more short-term, there's more narrowly focused on Britain's economy objectives here. So Britain's economy is kind of stalled. There was the financial crash of 2008, and things have picked up some, but it's still pretty sluggish. And so they want to do anything they can to get more money coming into Britain, more money flowing into Britain, to get the economy really rolling again. And so they see China, the big spender, the economy that's growing still at 6 or 7% a year, I think, if memory serves me correctly, to come and to invest more in Britain, because China's one of the few places that's growing right now.
It's interesting, like I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, you have to view this in light of some of these extremely provocative moves that China has made. What are some of the things that Britain is overlooking? Like we tend to think of Britain as more concerned about human rights, about, say, matters of principle when it comes to engaging other nations in relationships like this. What are they throwing out the window and overlooking in order to go all in this the way that they're treating China right now?
Well, absolutely. They are overlooking the human rights. And I mean, just recently, China's one child policy has been in the news a lot. And that's just one aspect and one of many rules within China. And you just look at all the human rights abuses alone that implementing that, and the forced abortions and the mass number of abortions over there, essentially killing babies to uphold this policy. And that's just one. But Britain also has a fairly long tradition of a pragmatic foreign policy. There have been some great prime ministers, I think Benjamin Disraeli springs to mind, who have been willing to overlook human rights resources and lead a successful pragmatic foreign policy to Britain's advantage. But even from a pragmatic point of view, a lot of what Britain is doing doesn't make sense. So the big one that stands out to this is allowing Britain to come in and build a nuclear power plant.
Or into Britain.
Allowing China to come in and build a nuclear power plant in Britain. And it wasn't long ago that, just a few years ago, where there was a Chinese company that was going to give up, major Chinese company, give up doing business in the United States because American companies just didn't trust them in their infrastructure. The American government didn't trust using them in their power plants or anywhere near anything critical, just because there's so much cyber espionage going on in China.
What's been happening in recent months, it proves the wisdom in that decision, doesn't it? And for Britain to look at it, you know, obviously they're aware of what's gone on with the United States, and for them to say, well, you know, we think that they're trustworthy and allow them to have this very critical project built on British soil, it seems like, I'm just wondering, what does this tell us about Britain today that they're willing to place this kind of trust in China?
Right. It's a Britain today that is, that sees that it has a lot of problems, that sees the future doesn't look great, that it's just a future of decline, and sees the best way to fix that to just throw itself at other nations and do whatever those other nations want in order to get the help that they think they need to solve those problems. And so it sees a bleak economic future solution. While China's the raising power, go all out, do everything that we can do to seek China's help, and if they hack our systems, well, we'll pay that price. It's better than if we'd have just, it would still be in a better situation, they may think, than we would have been had they not helped us at all.
It's interesting to, you can almost see the way that the United States has responded to, say, the cyber espionage, very meek, very mild in terms of you know, being unwilling to pin blame on the state of China, you know, really playing up, well, you know, we can't really prove anything. They do not want to confront China. In a sense, it's almost a kind of mirror image, or it's a similar type of thing. It's just that Britain is going so much further in this. No one is willing to stand up to China.
No, and we have seen this over the past week, where shortly after President Xi came to Britain, Angela Merkel went to China, and now François Hollande has been meeting with top Chinese officials, the president of France, with top Chinese officials just this week. So definitely everybody sees the rise of China and wants to do business with China. But there's this unique fawning over China that characterizes Britain's foreign policy. If you look at someone like Angela Merkel, it seems like there's much more of a two-way relationship there. She seems to get some mutual respect from China. She's not afraid to criticize China, to call them out on some of those human rights abuses. It's very clear that from her that she's not going to bend over backwards and do whatever China wants. Now, she definitely wants a relationship. She's definitely seeking a relationship. But it's just not the same kind of no-holds-barred, reckless pursuit that you're getting from Britain. And actually, Merkel's approach seems much more successful. They do have a very good working business, financial, trade, and foreign policy relationship with the Chinese.
So we have talked at the Trumpet about, just looking at this from a standpoint of biblical prophecy, the possibility, or the what we would suggest, this relationship between Europe and China. It's actually spelled out, the possibility of these two getting together in that prophecy in Isaiah about a mart of nations. There's nothing like that with Britain and China suggested in prophecy. This is really something that we've never talked about, it because there's nothing in the Bible to, you know, that discusses a development along the lines of what we're describing here. But what might the ramifications be if we're looking at this from a biblical prophecy standpoint? One thought that I had is just what a demonstration this is about the fracturing of the, a demonstration this is of the fracturing of the relationship between the United States and Britain. And just how it's the fact that the United States has really turned its back on Britain that maybe has pushed Britain into taking some of these risks with China. Do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, firstly on that, one interesting aspect of it that I didn't really get into in this article, because it is a bit of a different subject, is some have been saying that, well, the British leadership are anticipating that they could leave the European Union. I don't think Britain's current leadership want that to happen. I think they're also pretty sure they can stop that from happening. But if Britain leaves the European Union, they're going to need other friends. And America hasn't been sounding very friendly. And in fact, they've been making threats. You know, we're going to do less trade with you if you leave the EU. You're not going to be able to sign bilateral trade agreements with us. And so the prospect of having less of a friend in European countries and less of a friend in America, that's definitely one thing that's pushing them towards China. I also think just this pursuit demonstrates as well just how far that relationship between Britain and America has already broken down. So you had one week you had President Xi visiting Britain. The next week you had Chinese state media saying we're not afraid of a war with the United States over these islands mm-hmm. in the South China Sea. And you had America sending in ships within the 12 miles of some of these islands, which it's a pretty weak response. But that still both nations are very clearly pulling in other directions. Britain's trying to draw close to China while America is in a very small way standing up to China. One's friendly, one's an enemy. So there's that demonstration of the break. But then also we have one relationship the Bible does prophesy is that Britain will move away from its relationship with America, but instead pursue a friendship and pursue an alliance with Germany. And the terminology the Bible uses is exactly the same type or strategy we see now employed by Britain's foreign policy establishment. It talks about Britain being like a lover throwing herself at some handsome man, and that love isn't really reciprocated, but it's just a very desperate pursuit. And that's exactly what we saw with China. And we did see exactly the same attitude when German Chancellor Angela Merkel came to visit Britain a year or two earlier. And again, it was the same type of language you saw in the press, the reddest of red carpets.
Right.
The royalist welcome possible, and exactly the same pageantry. And I believe even then there were things that hadn't happened in – I think there was like a joint address to the Houses of Parliament, if memory serves me correctly, which is a very rare honor for a foreign dignitary to be accorded that. And so – just this idea of Britain sees problems in itself, and it sees throwing itself headlong into a pursuit of a foreign nation as the solution to these problems. That is exactly in line with Bible prophecy, and we're seeing that thinking. And so all that we just expect some of that ardor to be transferred from China to Germany.
Fascinating, fascinating to watch. Thank you, Richard. We've been talking to Richard Palmer. He's via Skype over in Britain. He's written an article, Britain Bows to China. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Richard, very much.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Talks for peace in Syria are going on. Several nations are involved in these talks, including the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Iran? Yes, Iran. Russia has insisted that Iran be able to participate in these talks. As we talked about on the Week in Review last week, this is really a sign of just how much legitimacy and clout Iran has gained since concluding the nuclear deal this past summer. It's right there at the table, right alongside with the U.S. and other nations, supposedly talking about how to resolve this crisis in Syria that has killed hundreds of thousands of people, displaced millions of people. It wasn't that long ago that Iran was the pariah, that it was the world's number one state sponsor of terror, that it was part of what George W. Bush called the Axis of Evil, that it was suffering from multinational sanctions for its dangerous nuclear activities. Well, now it's one of the club. I want to talk about this, particularly in light of a couple of recent headlines that show just how remarkable this transformation is and really how bizarre it is. I've got Brent Noctegal here, our Middle East expert, to talk about this. We've got a lot to talk about here, Brent. I appreciate you coming in.
Yep, it's good to be here.
So, Brent, I have this Wall Street Journal article in front of me that I would call surreal. The title of this article, Iran May Withdraw from Syria Peace Talks. This is what happens when you invite Iran to the table in this kind of a situation. Now, it's suddenly it's the tough guy. and it's the one with all of the negotiating power. Iran will withdraw from talks for peace in Syria if the discussions turn into a forum for political bickering that fails to address the plight of the Syrian people. Iran, they're really concerned about these poor Syrian people. Did you know that? A senior Iranian official said on Monday, adding that Iran's chief regional rival, Saudi Arabia, had been playing a negative role. So this guy says, you know, we're not going to do this unless, he says, we assess these meetings as being positive. Then we'll take part. So we've talked a lot about this confrontational relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran in the Middle East. These are really, Iran has really risen as the number one power in the region. Saudi Arabia has really positioned itself as their chief rival. And now this confrontation is actually playing out in this diplomatic forum with right alongside the United States and Russia. Is this actually happening?
Yeah, it's really strange. If you were reading just that headline from the Wall Street Journal, Iran may withdraw from Syria peace talks 5-6 years ago, you would...
5-6 months ago?
Well, even so, yeah. You would just wonder, is that real? Is that possible to even happen? So it is very interesting at how fast Iran has made it as a legitimate world power, legitimate broker for peace even. They're trying to say that they're going to leave if these talks aren't constructive for peace in Syria. And when we know that Iran over the past 30 years has probably done more to disrupt world peace than almost any other nation, especially in the Middle East, especially next door in Iraq, especially over in Syria. He says there in that quote, or at least the Iranian official, that he fears that they will leave if the talks get away from, you know, protecting the Syrian people, when it's very obvious and easily provable by anyone that Iran has been part author of the deaths of 200,000 people in Syria. But now they're ultra concerned about the Syrian population.
Yeah, when they're saying that, well, we need to make sure that we really focus on the plight of the Syrian people, I really wonder who they're talking about, because they've been the main power all along behind propping up Bashar Assad. And now they're talking like he's the solution to the problem.
Right. Now, that's not just Iran is pushing that, but we've already discussed in previous programs about Russia is trying to show as well that, you know, you've got a lot of these bad options in Syria, and who is going to be able to end the violence right now? That's if we support the state institutions, if we support the only government that looks like it would be able to successfully function as a government, and that is Assad, according to them. So Iran's just going along here with the Russian position that they've put forward, and that it looks like a lot of people are buying into. Even the United States seems to be buying into this as well.
Yeah,
it was only, you know, 6 months ago when the United States was still calling for Assad to definitely go. He needs to be out of there in any type of political situation going forward. He cannot rule. And at that time, we had Saudi Arabia as well calling for that. Now, Saudi Arabia is still calling for that. There must be an immediate end to Assad's rule, since Saudi Arabia correctly is noting that Assad has caused all these deaths. Yet over the past couple of weeks, we've seen the United States actually go towards the Iranian position, the Russian position, instead of backing their Saudi allies, saying that, oh, in some type of transitional government, we can see Assad staying in power for a while, and then it'll be up for elections, and whoever the people decide will back that.
What's to stop the Saudi Arabia negotiators from saying, oh, you don't like the way these discussions are going? Bye.
Yeah, you would say that they would, you would think that they would be happy with Iran leaving the negotiation table. But I think the Saudis are seeing that the other world powers are on the side of Iran as well. So they're going to have to probably try and stick it out there, the Saudis will, and see if they can get something for their influence and what they want inside Syria.
It seems like this just represents a complete collapse of the United States having any kind of principled position in this whole scenario. I mean, this is essentially them conceding that theater to Iran and to Russia.
Right, and you even have a lot of political commentators in the United States from both sides of the political persuasion, Democrats, Republicans, calling for a similar type thing. If Russia wants to get involved in the Middle East, and you know, that's good for us. Let's get out of there. It's been horrible for us for the past 20 years or so, 10 years specifically, and maybe that's a good thing. So it's crazy that type of line of thinking, to think that in the end it's going to be better in the Middle East, or even from American power around the world or influence in the Middle East, if America is out of there and Russia and Iran are taking over. Yet that seems to be exactly what the United States government is pushing and even happy with.
And I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of an American negotiator who's sitting at the table and listening to an intransigent Iranian negotiating team saying, look, this either goes our way or we're out of here, and just thinking, what kind of monster have we created here?
Yeah, all in for the guise of bringing Iran back into the community of nations. We knew that was a big goal for President Obama. Even when he took office, he did state that he really wanted, you know, to bring Iran to the negotiating table, and they did that through the nuclear talks, which we've seen how much they've been a debacle. So I really wonder whether the United States, sitting across from the table at Iran, looking around and seeing 18 other or 17 other nations there, thinking however this goes in Syria, I mean, that it has been in some ways a success. I mean, Iran's there. It seems like that was part of the end goal, not to convert Iran over to Western positions, but to just bring Iran along.
You know, the whole time those negotiations were going on over Iran's nuclear program, it seemed like there were several junctures where Iran was the one that acted as though it held all the cards in its favor. You know, either this goes our way or we're going to walk away. And it was the Americans who were, no, come back. You know, we can accommodate, or we'll figure out this. And it was always, the concessions were always on the American side. I mean, for the most part, there are some things that the Iranians agreed to that kind of gave the appearance of some kind of accommodation on their part. But really, it was the Americans who were so desperate for this deal. It was this White House that was so desperate for this deal. And the fact that here we are in the first post-nuclear deal environment, in a diplomatic environment where Iran is basically playing the same cards, and they're the ones who are driving this. They're the ones who are saying, well, we're going to walk away if our demands aren't met. And, you know, it's really more of the same thing. That I just wonder, you know, at what point do the Americans say, we've really looked like fools through all of this process?
Yeah, I don't really know how to answer that, because I don't know when that realization is going to take place. There seems to be ample proof that there hasn't been a change in the way Iran thinks about the United States, or, you know, about Western values. They haven't changed one bit, and yet the United States is completely willing to keep on working with them, thinking possibly that they will change in the future, when there has been absolutely no evidence that will be the case.
So just to back up that point, here's another headline. This is from the Daily Mail on Monday. Death to America stands despite nuclear deal, say Iran MPs. Clear majority of Iranian legislators said Monday the Islamic Republic will not abandon the slogan of death to America despite its July nuclear accord with nuclear powers. It says the martyr-nurturing nation of Iran is not at all prepared to abandon the slogan of death to America under the pretext of a nuclear agreement. This is 192 members of a 290-seat parliament in Iran in a statement that was carried by the state news agency. They said the slogan chanted at the weekly Friday prayers in mosques and at protests had turned into a symbol of the Islamic Republic and all struggling nations. So again, like you said, no change whatsoever. Here's a nation that has death to America as this kind of official slogan. What other nation is afforded this kind of accommodation? What other nation that acts like this is treated as a member of the club, that you can just go ahead and we'll treat you as if you're a legitimate participant in peace talks? Peace talks. How do you reconcile this and just the accommodation with Iran with, say, the way that Israel is treated, you know, for some of the moves that it makes that are supposedly so horrible, you know, protecting themselves against terrorists and that type of thing? They need to be sanctioned. They need to be pilloried. It's a remarkable double standard.
Well, what you don't actually realize is that death to America doesn't actually mean death to America's people. That's what the Ayatollah Khamenei came out and said yesterday, on Tuesday. This is what he said. It's aimed mainly at the U.S. policies, as well as the arrogance of the United States, but not actually calling for death, actual death of Americans. But to just show how ludicrous that statement is, this is where that statement was made. He discussed the slogan while meeting with Iranian students ahead of the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran on November 4th, 1979. So he's saying that, no, I don't actually believe in the death to America, meaning their people, but he's saying this at a rally that's commemorating to this day the takeover of the U.S. embassy inside Tehran.
It's remarkable. We had an article in our May June issue. It was by trumpet writer Brad McDonald, and he was just talking about the title of the article was "America's Chamberlain," speaking of the president of the United States, and just how much responsibility America bears for Iran's rise. And it's really interesting watching this play out with these Syria peace talks. Obviously, Russia is positioning itself as Iran's champion. And Assad's champion, but they're really taking advantage of the opening that the United States has given. It's been America. You could look back all the way back to 2003 when we toppled Saddam Hussein and took Iraq out of the equation and really opened the door for Iran to emerge as the hegemon in the region. What's happened since then, though, and particularly with respect to these nuclear talks, is it's just basically handing the region over to Iran and saying, you know, you're giving it the opportunity to take over in a way that it never would have without America's help.
Right. And you see that the Saudis are looking at that as well. They see what's happened over the past 10 years, and they've got to be wondering about, you know, whether there is any potential of American support any longer. I mean, the Saudis are the big losers in the Gulf states. They're the big losers in this. We used to love the Saudis because they would stand up to Iran even after Saddam Hussein fell, and we knew that Iran was going to take Iraq, and we can see that happening. At least there would be the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia that we could support to ensure that there was an alliance against the growth of Iran. Yet the Saudis, they must feel stabbed in the back every way along, just because they can see that they no longer have a backer that's willing to stand up and fight for them. You can look even in what's Iran doing right now. Yes, they're in Iraq, they're in Syria, but then it wasn't about 6 months ago now that Iranians led a takeover in Yemen as well against Saudi interests. And the United States back then didn't do much as well, and they just let it happen. So there's another theater that we can see that Iran is dominating the Middle East, and yet Saudi Arabia is by themselves.
You know, this just really seems like a picture of what to expect in the months ahead. The prophecy that we draw attention to so often, the rise of Iran as the king of the South, is prophesied in Daniel 11. The king of the South, basically the predominant power in the region, a couple of other nations that are going to be allied with it. But this really is a remarkable demonstration of what we can expect to see in the time ahead in fulfillment of that prophecy. Very interesting, Brent. I'd like to keep you around for the second segment. We're going to talk about another development in the Middle East, and so we'll be right back with that.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Big archaeological news this week. Researchers with the Israel Antiquities Authority announced Tuesday that they've found the remnants of a fortress used by Antiochus Epiphanes in his siege of Jerusalem in 168 BCE. Antiochus, one of the worst villains in Jewish history. And what's been uncovered here peels the lid off of some brutal history in that part of the world. Archaeologists are describing this as, quote, a solution to one of the great archaeological riddles in the history of Jerusalem. Brent Nachtigall has worked as an archaeologist over there, and he's always locked into new news from that region. He's here to tell us about this. So, Brent, can you give us an overview of the history, maybe as we've understood it before this discovery, from that era?
Okay, well, there hasn't actually been too much archaeological evidence for this period of Antiochus, of this period of the Maccabees inside Jerusalem up until this point. And so it's kind of dramatic that they have found such a huge fortification wall, a massive tower as well, belonging to this very specific time of Antiochus Epiphanes.
So the history as we've known it, it's essentially coming from the Book of Maccabees?
Right. The first Book of the Maccabees, that's pretty much an eyewitness report from a historian that was there watching these things take place. That's first Maccabees. Second Maccabees, it adds a little bit of detail to the takeover and the same period, but it's less reliable since it was written a few hundred years later. So we have the Book of Maccabees and also Josephus, the first century Jewish historian as well, that records about this big construction, massive construction of a citadel known as the Acra, is what both Maccabees and Josephus call it, that was built in the northern part of the city of David, of ancient Jerusalem, by Antiochus once he took over Jerusalem, as you said, in 168 BC. Now, up to this point, there have been people that have thought and assumed and given theories and hypotheses of where this Acra was. And some thought it was on the other side of the Temple Mount today. But what this has shown, this recent find, is that no, the Acra was south of the Temple Mount and substantially south of the Temple Mount by probably, I don't know, 600, 700 feet.
And what function did this citadel serve for Antiochus? Like, say, historically speaking, what does this represent and what does it tell us about what he did in that area?
Right. So it's important just to recall the history of Antiochus Epiphanes and his attack on the fledgling Jewish state back then. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes came into power in 175 BC, and then for the first couple of years of his reign, his kingdom, the Seleucid kingdom, was actually over the area of Palestine. The Jewish leaders, Jewish high priests, they ruled underneath the Seleucid king, which was Antiochus, and they ruled by his graces, good graces, if that's possible to put a phrase with Antiochus. But over those years preceding to the takeover of Jerusalem, you had a number of high priests in Jerusalem, high priests of the Jews, that was actually the head of state of the Jews as well, and they would be going up to Antiochus Epiphanes in Antioch in Syria and asking and bribing the king for that office. So you had Antiochus being involved in that way. Jerusalem itself, there was a push from the hierarchy, including the high priest, to Hellenize the city, to allow it to become a similar Greek-style city that you could find in other areas of Antiochus's empire. But eventually, Antiochus Epiphanes, he kind of got fed up with the Jews and their bickering, and there was some internal domestic stuff that he didn't like. So he unleashed a living hell, really, on the Jews around 168 BC. What he did in the temple, we know what he did in the temple. That's been recorded for us in the different historical documents. He went into the Jewish temple. He stopped the daily sacrifice from being taking place. He sacrificed pigs, swine's flesh on the altar of sacrifice. He set up a statue of Jupiter inside the Holy of Holies in the temple there for the Jews.
Just deliberately desecrating everything that was important and holy.
Everything that was holy. And then also he went after the law as well. He went after the first five books of the Bible that were written down, that would have existed in different copies in people's houses in the temple. And he said, if I find this law on anybody, in anybody's presence, I am going to put those people to death. And he did. He had a huge massacre against the Jewish people, led a huge massacre against the Jewish people and against the constitution of the Jews at that time, which was those first five books of the Bible. Now, this Acra is important, a very important building, because in 168, when he conquered Jerusalem, and then he sent out all his parties throughout Judea trying to destroy the religion of the Jews. But inside Jerusalem, he fortified the northern areas of the city of David with this new stronghold, this new massive castle, to ensure that Jerusalem would not be able to return to their worship and would not be able to rid the Hellenists or the Seleucid Empire, his men, from Jerusalem. So in 168, he builds this. And then he stations a lot of his troops, a garrison of troops, inside this Acra. And Then he leaves and goes back to Syria and deals with the rest of his empire. Meanwhile, there is a rebellion that is sparked on the outskirts of Judea by a famous family of the Maccabees. They're also known as the Hasmoneans, and people are probably aware of that, a little bit about that history, at least heard that name, the Maccabees or the Hasmoneans. And they started to fight against this policy of Antiochus to do away with the law completely, and that would basically had destroyed every vestige of the law apart from where their hometown was.
And that Acra really represented that, his effort to cement that violation of the Jews' national identity.
Right. He did not want that national fervor of the people to continue or to be able to have a comeback. So what would you do? The center of religious worship at that time was the temple. So right outside the temple, you put your massive castle to ensure that that doesn't happen again, that the people are excited religiously. That's a general policy of most people that take over, try and destroy the national institutions, the history of the people, then they don't know what they're fighting for. So that was part of this reason for the Acra. Now, the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes was successful, but the Acra stayed in its place. It's interesting. Judas Maccabeus, he's the commander of the army of the Maccabees that would start out having raiding parties against different Seleucid troops inside Judea. Eventually, after 3 years, or the 1150 days that we know is prophesied in Daniel 11, that history, Judas leads his army to Jerusalem and actually defeats Seleucid forces. He purifies the temple, cleanses the temple, and they can start sacrificing again. But what can't he do? He's still unsuccessful at taking the troops out of this Acra. In fact, for the next 20 years, you're going to have Syrian troops stationed inside a castle, inside of Jerusalem, overlooking the temple while the Jews are trying to continue their national religion. That's how much a formidable castle this was. Now, it was Judas's elder brother Simon, once he came into power in 142 BC, and 141, he led an attack against this Acra. So in 168, if we just think about back in the chronology here, 168, Antiochus builds this huge fortress using some existing walls that would have been there at the time. And then 167, the rebellion against his overhaul of Judea starts. 165, 164, you have Judas Maccabeus getting into Jerusalem. And then for the other 20 years, you have these troops right there as a thorn in the side of the worshipers at the temple. I mean, there's accounts of these troops firing down into the temple, arrows and such, to disrupt the service of the temple even through these 20 years. Now, this specific site that was uncovered just in the past few months, well, these finds that we're talking about today, they have proof of this in the material that is touching these walls and underneath and around these walls. They've found arrowheads, bronze arrowheads with a trident impressed on them. And that trident is part of the sign of Antiochus Epiphanes, which is interesting in itself. They've found coins from Antiochus's time there as well to date this structure. So we know it is from his time. Now, there will be people, I'm sure, that will come out and say, this isn't the Acra. The Acra was somewhere else. But what you have is a pretty firm corroboration of what First Maccabees says and what Josephus says. It says in those books that Antiochus took over the city, and in the city of David, which is right where this was found, the very northern reaches of it, he built up his Acra, or his citadel.
So in addition to corroborating the accounts that we read in Josephus and the books of Maccabees, what else has this revealed to us about that history, and what is it that, why is it being called this great archaeological riddle being solved?
Well, it gets back to the fact that nobody really knew where this was. People didn't believe Josephus. People didn't believe First Maccabees, and they thought, it says actually inside those books that this Acra was able to overlook the temple. Now, if people are, you know, generally the consensus is that the temple is further north on higher ground, that this Acra would have to be built on higher ground to overlook the temple so it could continue to fire upon the Jews and such. Now, what this has revealed is, no, actually, Josephus was right. And we are digging right here on the northern edges of the city of David, and we find this massive structure. I mean, it's this, the walls are 4 meters thick. It's a huge structure that if you were going to try and take, that's why it stood for 20 years, even though they had the Jews all around them, they could withstand those attacks. So it is going to, I think, affect the way people think about the temple and the location of the temple potentially as well, because this Acre is probably a little bit further south than people naturally would assume. Now, we'll see. There hasn't been too much yet. Archaeologists will pore over this. There's only been a statement that's been released by the Antiquities Authority and a short discussion by the director of the dig there, co-director Daron Ben-Ami. He's given a little talk about this as well. But other archaeologists will try and look at the proof and see whether they agree with his understanding that this is the Acre. I think it's another important feature of this is that it has defined the boundaries of the city of David at that time as well. The western, this is very interesting because up to this time, the western boundary of the city of David, the ancient city of Jerusalem, has been up for debate a little bit as well. But on this western side now, we find this huge wall that actually the glacier or the sloped wall that comes up against this wall goes all the way down into the valley, so that we know that this is the border of the city as well. So that's just an interesting tidbit for archaeologists to know the exact location of the city wall.
Really interesting history. We've been talking with the archaeologist Brent Noctegal about this new discovery in Israel, remnants of a fortress used by Antiochus Epiphanes in the first century BC. Sure appreciate you explaining this to us, Brent. Thanks for coming in.
No problem. It's been enjoyable.
It's time for today's last word.
A lot of what passes for love is nothing of the sort. Few parents would say they don't love their children, but many don't really enjoy being around their children. Many give them money or things instead of personal time. Many give free access to a multitude of destructive influences. These things aren't love. Love must be the most misused, misunderstood word in our language. What is love, actually? The definition in the Bible is quite concrete and quite specific. Firstly, it says in 1 John 4 that God is love. Everything God does is love. His actions define love and help us to recognize what true love is. Of course, there are different and competing ideas of what God is. So let's look further. Another biblical definition of love is in 2 John 6, and this is love, that we walk after his commandments. So that's getting quite specific. Love isn't a hazy emotion. It is God's way of life. He outlined and provided details of that way of life in his commandments. By keeping them, not reluctantly, but with joyful obedience from the heart, we live that way of life, and we prove through experience just what God's love is. 1 John 5 and verse 3 says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous." God's law represents and expresses his love. He gave it in order to spare us misery and heartache, to bring peace into our relationships and within our own minds. A lot of people use the term legalistic as an epithet. They say that law is oppressive, that authority is harsh. Well, the Bible says the opposite. It says that God's law is a great blessing. Scripture even tells us, carefully obey even the laws of the land that don't conflict with God's law. Why is that? It's because a law-abiding people is far happier and more peaceful than a lawless people. Just compare a school where students have free rein to a school where students respect teachers and administrators and obey the rules. One is a dead end. The other actually enables young people to learn and prepare for productive adulthood. We're all inspired by stories of an authoritative principal who transforms a lawless school into a lawful one, freeing children from squalor and giving them an opportunity to succeed in life. When we apply the law and we lay down rules for our children, We would do well to remember this. The purpose of the law is to help our children's joy. It's to facilitate their learning, to safeguard their happiness, to guarantee their safety and the safety of those around them. It's to teach them the submission to authority that's going to prepare them for an eternal loving relationship with God. The law is not a bludgeon, but a blessing. Measure your attitude and that of your children against this standard. The devil does his best to make us all resist and despise law and authority. We need not only to control our own thinking in order to love government and to see law for the blessing it is, but also to help our children do the same. Where those who deride this approach as legalistic go off track, as so many parents today do, is they fail to recognize God's judgment and God's correction as expressions of God's love. And that demonstrates total lack of understanding of the God of the Bible. The Apostle Paul wrote that, "Whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives." Jesus Christ himself says, "As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Be zealous, therefore, and repent." While he was in the flesh, he flipped over tables in order to drive mercenaries out of his father's house. He gave stern tongue lashings to unrepentant people. He rebuked and chastened. He demanded repentance, not because he hated people, but because he loved them. To the Pharisees, he unceremoniously called them hypocrites, serpents, vipers. He said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kills the prophets and stoned them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not? Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." Their severe punishment was necessitated by their rebellion against God's messengers, their rejection of God's love. If we understand the beautiful purpose of law, then the application of rebuke and chastening for disobedience makes perfect sense. God always aims it at redirecting our errant steps in order to guide us back onto the path of law-keeping that results in blessings. Sure, God gets angry, but he remains controlled. He never punishes beyond what is deserved. His anger is not contrary to his love. It's a product of his love. Truly, God is always eager to extend mercy and forgiveness to someone who repents, who's willing to turn from sin. God loves everyone unconditionally. He holds out hope for the repentance of every sinner. That is the truth of the Bible, both in the New Testament and in the Old. We should always try to emulate God's example as parents. If we find ourselves getting frustrated, out of control, angry, vindictive, worn out with our children, we need to stop. We need to humble ourselves. Pray for help to ensure that our actions are nothing less than expressions of unconditional love for our children. There shouldn't be any doubt in our children's minds that we love them unconditionally. Our aim is to be just in our judgment, measured in our discipline, generous with our instruction and teaching, and big-hearted in giving our children blessings when they obey. That is exactly how God parents. The better we do those things, the greater the likelihood that our children will grow up recognizing and sincerely appreciating the unbreakable connections between law, government, love, and God. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talk about on this program. We'll also give you a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Napoleon Hill. Desire is the starting point of all achievement. not a hope, not a wish, but a keen, pulsating desire which transcends everything. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.